We stayed 2 nights with Arlo.
Arlo Sugarman?
She nods. In Tulsa. He was posing as a student at Oral Roberts University, which I thought was pretty ironic.
Why's that?
Arlo was raised Jewish, but prided himself on his atheism. I remember something I saw in the file. Sugarman claimed he wasn't there that night. We all did, so what?
Fair enough. Wasn't he a fine arts major at Columbia?
Yeah, maybe. Wait, you think Arlo and Rye...
Do you?
No. I mean, I don't know for sure, but... I think now about Cousin Patricia and the horror of what she went through. You mentioned Rye Strauss hurting you. She swallows. What about it? You changed your entire identity. You pretty much went off the grid. Yet you found me.
I try to look modest. Then I ask, were you afraid Rye would try to find you?
Not just Rye.
Who?
She shakes me off, and I can see she is starting to close down. There is a chance, I say, that Rye Strauss was involved in something more sinister than stolen art.
How much more sinister?
I see no reason to sugarcoat it. Abducting, raping, and eventually murdering young women. Her face loses all color. Perhaps with a partner, I add. Then I ask, do you think Rye could have been involved in something like that?
No, she says softly. And I really think you should leave now.
Chapter 9. Back on the plane, I start reading through the FBI file. I call it a file, but in fact it is a 3 inches thick binder with photocopied pages. I take out my Mont Blanc and jot down the names of the Jane Street Six. Rye Strauss, Arlo Sugarman, Lake Davies, Jane Dorchester, Billy Rowan, Edie Parker, Lionel Underwood. I stare at the names for a moment. When I do, when I think of these six and the fact that only one, now two if you include Rye Strauss, has been seen or heard from in 40 years, it becomes apparent that P.T. is probably right about their fate. Odds are strong that at least some of them, if not all, are dead. Then again, perhaps not. Hadn't Rye Strauss managed to survive all these years before he was brutally murdered? If Strauss could hide in the center of the largest city in the country, why couldn't the others stay underground? Oddly enough, I am not buying my own rationale. One could stay hidden, two, perhaps, but four? Unlikely. I start with the timeline and write down the following question. Who has been seen since the night of the Molotov cocktails? Day 1, 2, and 3 post-attack, there were no credible sightings of any of the Jane Street Six. Pretty remarkable when you think of the manhunt. On day 4, there was finally a break. The FBI received an anonymous tip that Arlo Sugarman was holed up at a brownstone in the Bronx. Alas, we know how that turned out. Special Agent Patrick O'Malley ends up being shot and killed on the stoop. I jot this incident down next to Sugarman's name, because it is his first known sighting. The second sighting, according to what I just learned from Lake Davies, places Arlo Sugarman in Tulsa, Oklahoma, as a student at Oral Roberts University in 1975. I mark that down, too. That's it on Sugarman. No third sighting. I move on to Billy Rowan. According to the FBI file, Rowan was spotted only once since the attack, 2 weeks later, by Vanessa Hogan, the mother of one of the victims, Frederick Hogan, a 17-year-old from Great Neck, New York. Vanessa Hogan, a devoutly religious woman, had gone on television almost immediately after her son's death to say she had forgiven those who harmed young Frederick. God must have wanted my Frederick for a higher purpose, she said at the press conference. I hate this sort of justification. I hate it even more when it's reversed, if you will, when a survivor of a tragedy claims something to the effect that God spared me because I'm special to him, the subtle implication being that God didn't give a damn about those who perished, In this case, however, Vanessa Hogan was a young widow who had just lost her only child, so perhaps I should cut her some slack. I digress. According to the FBI report, 2 weeks after Vanessa Hogan's press conference, when the intensity of the search had waned just enough, Billy Rowan, who had also been raised in a devoutly religious home, knocked on Hogan's back door at approximately 9 p.m. Vanessa Hogan was home alone in her kitchen at the time. Billy Rowan had purportedly seen her on TV and wanted to apologize in person before he went fully underground. Okay, fine. I note this next to Rowan's name, first and only sighting. I move on to the rest. Edie Parker, no sightings. And Lionel Underwood, no sightings. And of course, when I was handed the file, Rye Strauss, no sightings. I tap my lip with my Mont Blanc and mull it over. Let's suppose that they had all successfully stayed underground for all these years. Do I really believe that they never, not once, reached out to family members? I do not. I scan through the file and jot down the names of close relatives I could potentially question. Rye Strauss had a quasi-famous brother, Saul, a progressive attorney who represents the downtrodden. He's a television talking head, but then again, who isn't nowadays? Did Rye never contact his brother Saul, even though they had lived in the same city for perhaps 40 years? It's worth an ask. Saul Strauss, I know, has been on Hester Krimstein's news program, ridiculously named Krimstein on Crime. Perhaps Hester could offer an introduction. The Strauss's parents are deceased. In fact, of the Jane Street Six's potential 12 parents, only 2 are still alive. Billy Rowan's father, Edie Parker's mother. I write their names down. Next, I go through surviving siblings besides Saul Strauss. That adds another 9 people, though 2 of those belong to Lake Davies, so I won't need them. I add those names to my list. If I have more time or help, I might spread my family tree out, uncles, aunts, cousins, but I doubt that I will. There are a lot of names here. I will need help. My thoughts naturally gravitate to Myron. He is down in Florida, taking care of his parents and helping his wife settle into a new job. I don't want to take him away from that. Those who know us well would note that I always came through when Myron would engage in similar quixotic quests and ask for my help, that in fact, after all the times I marched into battle for him without question or pause, Myron owes me. Those folks would be wrong. Let me clue you in on the advice Myron's father, one of the wisest men I know, gave his son and his son's best man, that would be yours truly, on Myron's wedding day. Relationships are never 50-50. Sometimes they are 60-40, sometimes 80-20. You'll be the 80 sometimes, you'll be the 20 others. The key is to accept and be okay with that. I believe this simple wisdom is true for all great relationships, not just marriages. So, if you add it up, how my friendship with Myron has improved and enhanced my life? No, Myron owes me nothing. My phone pings a reminder that I have not yet responded to my rendezvous app. I doubt there will be time tonight, but it would be rude to not reply. When I click the notification and scan the request, my eyes widen. I quickly change my mind and set up a meet for 8 p.m. tonight. Let me explain why. The rendezvous app has a rather unusual bio page. No, it's not like the dating apps where you spew out exaggerated nonsense about how you like piña coladas and getting caught in the rain. This page starts about akin to ratings one might give an Uber, but because most members use the app on rare occasions, unlike yours truly, the developers have supplemented personal ratings with what could crudely be called an appearance ranking. It's a far more complicated algorithm than that, scoring in many specific physical fields and on many levels. One of the app rules states that if you ask another client about your ranking, or if that client tells you, you are both immediately forced to relinquish your membership. I, for example, do not know what my rankings are. I am confident that they are high. No need for false modesty, is there? To give you an idea, Bitsy Cabot's aggregate ranking was an accurate 7.8 out of 10. The lowest I would go for is a 6.5. Well, okay, once I went with a 6.0, but nothing else was available. The app's scoring is very tough. A 6 on this app would be considered at least an 8 anywhere else. The highest ranking I've seen on the app? I was once with a 9.1. She'd been a renowned supermodel before she married a famous rock star. You know her name. That was the only woman above a 9 I'd ever seen. The woman who had currently pinged me for a rendezvous? Her ranking was a 9.85. There is no way I was passing that up. PT calls me. How'd it go with Lake Davies? I started with the obvious. She lied about Strauss being dead. I then fill him in on the rest of our conversation.
So what's your next step?
Go to Malachy's pub.
40 years later?
Yes.
Long shot.
Is there any other kind, I counter?
What else?
I've compiled a list of people I may want to interrogate. I need your people to get me current addresses.
Email me the list.
I know how PT works. He gets the information before he gives the information. Now that I've done my part, I prompt him.
Anything new on your end? We got week-old CCTV footage from the Beresford. We think it's from the day of the murder, but...
I wait.
We don't know how helpful it'll be, he says.
Is the killer on it?
Likely, yeah, but we can't really see much.
I'd like to view it.
I can email you a link in an hour.
I mull this over for a moment. I'd rather stop by the Beresford and have one of the doormen show it to me.
I'll set it up.
I will go to Malachy's first.
One more thing, Wynne.
I wait.
We can't keep the ID quiet any longer. Tomorrow morning, the director is going to announce the body belongs to Rye Strauss. Ain't you a good-looking fella?
Yes, I say, yes I am. Kathleen, the longtime barmaid at Malachy's, cackles a half-laugh, half-cigarette cough at that one. She has a wry, I mean that in two ways, smile, and yellow, as opposed to blonde, hair. Kathleen is comfortably north of 60 years old, but she wears it with confidence and an old-world sultry appeal that some might describe as burlesque. She is buxom and curvy and soft. I like Kathleen immediately, but I recognize that it is her occupation to be liked.
If I was a little younger,
Kathleen begins. Or if I were a little luckier, I counter.
Oh, stop.
I arch an eyebrow. It's one of my trademark moves.
Don't sell yourself short, Kathleen. The night is young. Oh, you're being fresh.
She playfully slaps me with a dish rag, last laundered during the Eisenhower administration.
Charming. Good looking as hell, but fresh.
On the stool to my right, Frankie Boy, who is closer to 80, wears a tweed flat cap. Thick tufts of hair jut out of his ears like troll dolls turned on their side. His nose couldn't be more bulbous without cosmetic surgery. I have been to Malachy's perhaps 5 times prior to tonight. Frankie Boy is always at this stool. Buy you a drink, I say to him.
Okay, Frankie slurs. But just for the record, I don't think you're that good looking.
Sure you do, I say.
Yeah, maybe, but that doesn't mean I'm gonna have sex with you.
I sigh. Dreams die hard in here. He likes that. As I said before, Malachy's is a legit dive bar. Poor lighting, stained, and I mean that in two ways, wood paneling. Dead flies in the light fixtures. Patrons so regular that it's sometimes hard to see where the stool ends and their butts begin. A sign above the bar reads, "Life is good, so is beer." Wisdom. Regulars blend well with the newcomers, and pretty much anything goes but pretension. There are two televisions, one set up at either end of the bar. The New York Yankees are losing on one, the New York Rangers are losing on the other. No one in Malachy's seems to be too invested in either. The menu is standard pub fare. Frankie Boy insists I order the chicken wings. Out comes a plate of grease with a smattering of bone. I slide it to him. We chat. Frankie tells me that he is on his fourth wife.
I love her so much,
Frankie Boy tells me.
Congrats.
Of course, I loved the other three so much, too. Still do.
A tear comes to his eye.
That's my problem. I fall hard, then I come in here to forget. Do you know what I'm saying?
I don't, but I tell him that I do. The song True by Spandau Ballet comes drifting out of the speakers. Frankie Boy starts singing along.
This is the sound of my soul. This is the sound.
He stops and turns to me.
You ever been married, Wynn?
No.
Smart. Wait, you gay?
No.
Not that I care. Be honest, I like a lot of the gays in here. Less competition for the ladies. You know what I'm saying?
I ask him how long he's been coming to Malachy's.
First time was January 12, 1966.
Specific, I say.
Biggest day of my life.
Why? I ask, genuinely curious. Frankie Boy holds up three stubby fingers.
Three reasons.
Go on. He drops the ring finger.
One, that's the first day I found this place.
Makes sense.
Two,
Frankie Boy drops his middle finger.
I married my first wife, Esmeralda.
You went to Malachy's for the first time on your wedding day?
I was getting married,
he said, emphasis on the married.
Who'd blame a man for needing a stiff drink or two beforehand?
Not I.
My Esmeralda was so beautiful, big as a barn. She wore a bright yellow wedding dress. In our wedding pictures, I look like a tiny planet orbiting a giant sun. But beautiful.
And what's reason three, I ask.
You may be too young, but did you ever see the TV show Batman?
Oh, yes. This, I think to myself, is kismet. Myron and I have watched every episode at least a million times. I nod. Adam West, Burt Ward.
Exactly. The Riddler, the Penguin. Oh, don't even get me started on Julie Newmar as the Catwoman. I would have ripped off Esmeralda's right arm and slapped myself silly with it just to sniff Julie Newmar's hair. No offense.
None taken.
And nowadays, we have all these,
finger quotes,
method actors losing 100 pounds or whatever to play the Joker. I bet back then, Cesar Romero didn't even bother shaving his mustache. Just threw white makeup over it. That,
my friend,
was acting.
I see no reason to disagree. And reason three? He scoffed.
I thought you were a fan.
I am.
So what villain appeared in the very first episode?
The Riddler, I say, played by Frank Gorshin.
Correct answer. And when did it first air?
Frankie Boy smiles and nods.
January 12th? 1966.
I want to kiss this man. So, to summarize, I say, on your wedding day, You went for drinks at Malachi's, and then you watched Batman debut on TV. Frankie Boy nods solemnly and stares down at his drink.
50 years later, Malachi's is still in my life. 50 years later, I can still watch Batman on my old VCR.
Big shrug.
But Esmeralda, she's long gone.
We drink in silence for a moment. I need to get to the point of my visit, but I'm really enjoying this conversation. Eventually, I work my way to asking Frankie Boy whether he remembers a waitress or barmaid named Sheila or Shelley or something like that. I hope that perhaps Lake Davies slipped up and gave me the real name, and he scratches his head.
Kathleen!
He shouts.
What? You remember Sheila, who worked here a long time ago? Huh?
Kathleen is smiling, but I detect something awry in her body language. Perhaps it is the smile that suddenly seems forced. Perhaps it is the way her grip tightens on the beer tap.
Who wants to know? Our good-looking friend Wing here,
Frankie Boy says, slapping my back. Kathleen heads back toward us. She has the dish rag over her shoulder.
Sheila what?
I don't know, I say. She shakes her head.
Don't remember Sheila. How about you, Frankie?
He shakes his head, too, and jumps down from the stool.
Ugh, gotta take a massive whiz,
he tells us.
With your prostate,
Kathleen counters.
Let a man dream, will ya?
Frankie Boy hobbles off. Kathleen turns back to me. She has the kind of expression that tells you she has seen it all at least twice. Google world weary, and her photograph pops up.
When would this Sheila have been here?
1975 or thereabouts, I say.
Seriously? That's like, what, more than 40 years ago?
I wait.
Anyway, I didn't start working here until 3 years later. Summer of 1978.
I see, I say. Anyone still here from those days?
Let me think.
Kathleen glances up at the ceiling to make a show of thinking this over.
Old Moses in the kitchen would have been here, but he retired for Florida last year. Other than that, well, I'm the most senior employee, I guess.
With that subject dismissed, she points to my empty glass and says,
"Get you another, hon?"
There is a time for the subtle. There is a time for the blunt. I confess that I'm far better with the blunt. With that in mind, I ask, "So what about the famous fugitives who hid in the basement?" Kathleen rears her head back and blinks.
Huh?
Have you ever heard of the Jane Street Six?
The what?
How about Rye Strauss? Her eyes narrow.
That name rings a bell, I think, but I don't see...
Rye Strauss and his girlfriend Lake Davies were wanted for murder. They hid in Malachi's basement in 1975. She doesn't reply for a few moments. Then she says,
I've heard a lot of legends about this place, but that's a new one.
But her voice is softer now. Kathleen, I've observed, usually plays for the entire bar, even in one-on-one conversations, as though the bar is a stage and she wants as big an audience as possible for every encounter. Now, suddenly, she wants an audience of only one. It's the truth, I say.
How do you know?
Lake Davies told me.
One of the fugitives?
She was caught and served her time.
And she told you she hid in this bar?
In the basement, yes. She told me a kind barmaid named Sheila looked after them. She said the kind barmaid saved her. We stare at one another for a moment.
Doubt it,
Kathleen says.
Why?
Ever been in our basement? I don't think anything outside the mold family could survive down there.
She cackles again, but it is far less organic now. As if on cue, a burly man on the far end of the stools slaps his hand down on the bar and gleefully shouts, "Got it!"
Kathleen yells, "What, Fred? A cockroach as big as one of those park pigeons!"
Kathleen smiles at me as if to say,
"See what I mean?"
"I don't think Lake Davies made it up," I say. Her reply starts with a shrug.
"Well, if she's like those other crazy radicals from back then, maybe she dropped too much acid and imagined it."
"Funny," I say.
"What?"
"I never mentioned that she was a radical." Kathleen smiles and leans a little closer. I get the cigarette smell again, though it's not entirely unpleasant.
"You said the Jane something six or whatever, and then I remembered they bombed something and killed people. Why are you asking about that anyway?"
"Because Rye Strauss has never been caught."
"And you're looking for him?"
"I am."
"Almost 50 years after the fact?"
"Yes," I say. "Can you help?"
"Wish I could."
She's trying too hard to act disinterested.
"Be good to see a killer like that get what's coming to him."
"You think so?"
"Damn straight. You a cop?"
I arch an eyebrow. "In this suit?" She gives another tobacco-laced laugh as Frankie Boy hops back on his stool.
"Fun talking to you," Kathleen says. Then, tilting her head, she adds, "I get customers."
She saunters away.
"Man,"
Frankie Boy says, watching her with awe.
"I can watch that caboose all day. You know what I'm saying?"
"I do."
"You a private eye, Win?"
"No."
"Like Sam Spade or Magnum P.I.?"
"No."
"But you're cool like them, am I right?"
"As rain," I agree, watching Kathleen work the tap. "As rain." Chapter 10. I have over an hour before my app rendezvous with Mrs. 9.85. The walk from Malachy's Pub to the Beresford takes me about 10 minutes. I head up Columbus Avenue and cut through the grounds of the American Museum of Natural History. When I was 6 years old, my parents were still together. They took my siblings and me to this very museum. The Lockwoods, of course, got a private tour before the museum was open to the general public. One of my earliest memories, and perhaps yours, swirls around the dinosaur bones in the entrance foyer, the woolly mammoth's tusks on the fourth floor, and mostly the huge blue whale hanging from the ceiling in the hall of ocean life. I still see that blue whale from time to time. At night, the museum hosts high-end gala dinners. I sit beneath the great whale and drink excellent scotch and look up at it. I try sometimes to see that little boy and his family, but I realize that what I'm conjuring up isn't real or stored in my brain. This is true for most, if not all, of what we call memories. Memories aren't kept on some microchip in the skull or filed away in a cabinet somewhere deep in our cranium. Memories are something we reconstruct and piece together. They are fragments we manufacture to create what we think occurred, or even simply hope to be true. In short, our memories are rarely accurate. They are biased reenactments. Shorter still, we all see what we want to see. The doorman at the Beresford is waiting for me. He leads me to the security monitors behind the desk. There, queued up on the screen, is a black and white image of two people walking single file. I can't make out much. The shot is from above, the quality not great. The person in front is likely Rye Strauss. He has a hoodie pulled over his head. The person behind him is totally bald. Both keep their heads down, walking so close together
that the bald head looks to be leaning on Strauss's back.
"Do you want me to hit play?"
the doorman asks. The doorman looks young, no more than 25. The military-style uniform he wears is far too big on his thin frame. I say, "This is the basement, correct?"
"Yeah,"